TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Richard Grossman, when injustice is legal, what do the abolitionists teach us about challenging corporate rule? This is a broadcast in memory of Richard Grossman, who died in November 2011. Richard Grossman was one of the great, uncompromising, courageous thinkers and activists in the unfolding project to define, limit, and abolish corporate power. By 1990, he was already talking about revoking the charter of corporations, such as Union Carbide, that caused the death of 25,000 in a 1984 chemical plant explosion in Bhopal, India. Ralph Nader called Grossman the preeminent historian of corporations, and the speech you are about to hear makes it obvious how he deserved that title. Grossman spoke at Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio in November 2006. He was then working with CELDEF, the Community Legal Defense Fund, and he describes a rich and inspiring set of anti-corporate actions from CELDEF's toolkit, ranging from outlawing corporate ownership of farmland to making illegal the poisoning of lands with toxic waste from mining and factory farming. Here's my introduction from the original TUC Radio broadcast. Richard Grossman refers back to the Revolutionary War and the Declaration of Independence and argues that this country needs to remember that we are born with inalienable rights that precede the formation of governments, and that governments indeed are tasked to protect. Grossman refers to the radical branch of the abolitionists, who in the mid-1800s, after much debate, found that they could not envision the restoration of rights under the then-existing U.S. Constitution. Even though attacked by their reformist associates, they eventually succeeded in rewriting the U.S. Constitution via the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. The title of his talk, When Injustice is Legal, points to the underlying problem with the current system. Local resistance needs to understand that it operates within a system that makes injustice legal and needs to go to work to ultimately rewrite parts of the Constitution.
Christopher Hill, who is an English historian, said something about history which I'd like to read. He wrote in 1972. History has to be rewritten in every generation. Although the past does not change, the present does. Each new generation asks new questions of the past and finds new areas of sympathy as it relives different aspects of the experiences of its predecessors. Most of our history is written about and from the point of view of a very tiny fragment of the population. Each generation, to put it another way, rescues new areas from what its predecessors arrogantly and snobbishly dismissed as the lunatic fringe. So I'm very happy to be part of that lunatic fringe of my generation. The Legal Defense Fund is located in Pennsylvania, in central Pennsylvania. And since 2002, little over 100 communities, townships, have passed a variety of laws, which are very unusual. Rural, Republican, conservative, farming, agricultural, poor. This is the area where these ordinances are being passed. We have ordinances that have banned particular corporations from doing particular deeds, from engaging in farming and owning farmland, from spreading urban sewage sludge, from longwall mining, from spreading dredge from the Delaware and Hudson Rivers. Three townships this fall have recognized the rights of nature, becoming the first governments in the United States, as far as we know, to actually recognize the rights of nature, ecosystems. And we'll see how that's going to work out. Why is this going on? Well, there's a simple answer and a more complicated answer. The simple answer is the people in those communities felt that they could not achieve the kinds of communities they wanted to have within the confines of what's called settled law. Because all of these laws, even though they all still stand, they're all contrary to settled constitutional law. They violate the Pennsylvania Constitution, they violate the United States Constitution, they violate numerous Pennsylvania state laws preempting communities from doing certain things. These communities knowingly put forward these laws and passed these laws because they felt that they could not achieve the kind of communities they wanted to achieve based on the structure of law that exists in Pennsylvania and the United States. There are varying degrees of consciousness about that. But we're going to talk about where that comes from. And one of the specific structures that they're dealing with is as follows. And it's true in Pennsylvania, it's true in New York, it's true in Ohio, it's true all around the country. And that is this: our states charter corporations, business corporations. Our states also charter municipal corporations, our villages, towns, cities, whatever. You would think that there would be some kind of just parallel between the nature of the powers and authorities that the communities have, where people live, and that the corporations have. In fact, you would think that the corporations should be subordinate to the communities. Isn't that logical, right? Historically, in this country, corporations have been called creatures of the state. They are subordinate entities. The communities where we live and our local governments are, in fact, expressions of the, allegedly, the sovereign will of the people. If we don't have democracy in our own communities, in our own villages and towns and cities, where are we going to have democracy, democratic self-governance? So you would, one would think, ideally, in a country, in a free country that's dedicated to democratic self-governance, you know, that ascribes to the principles of the American Revolution and the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, that, in fact, there could be no way that a business corporation chartered by the state would have more authority and more power under law than an municipal corporation chartered by the state. Unfortunately, that's not true, as these folks had discovered through years and years of organizing, trying to do things in their community. And what happens is that when, in fact, a state charters a business corporation, given the history that this country has gone through from its founding, you know, all through the 1900s and the 20th century, immediately that corporation, the directors of that corporation, are wrapped in the Constitution of the United States and wrapped in the Constitution of the state. They immediately have more power and authority than the state itself because of the history that we'll talk about tonight. And they are able then to use the wealth that they gain by doing business to affect the political process, the educational process, you know, the whole public, the public wheel. And what about the municipal corporation, the city, the village, the town? Well, you'll find, and you find this expressed most articulately in the lawyers, coming out of the lawyers' mouths representing these communities, particularly like in the communities we've been dealing with, where they've been taught in law school and it's been reaffirmed in their everyday life that, in fact, a municipal corporation, you know, where we live, where we, the smallest unit of government, where we're supposed to be governing ourselves, a municipal corporation has only the rights and powers expressly authorized by the state. So just think of that for a minute. You have the municipal corporation is a very limited entity kept on a very short leash by the state, by the legislature, by the governor, by the Supreme Court of each state. Well, the few people directing a business corporation, you know, let's say you have 10,000 people in a municipal corporation, they're held on a very short leash by the state and also by the federal government. You got 5 directors or 8 directors or 9 directors of a business corporation. As soon as they charter their corporation and file their papers with the Secretary of State and pay their $200 fee or whatever, they immediately have more power and authority, and power and authority to dictate, to govern over the municipality than the people in the municipality have. We see that in your state. The city of Cleveland had passed a law in 2002 banning predatory lending, right? And just the other day, your state Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional with this very simple line saying, any local ordinance that seeks to prohibit conduct that the state has authorized and is in conflict with the state statutes are therefore unconstitutional. Open and shut. That's settled law. There's nothing radical about that in this country. That's what we call settled law. And communities across the country for decades and decades and decades, generations, have been running into this reality. What they've been trying to do is use land use planning, zoning processes in order to try to make the corporate investments a little less assaulting, less harmful, to try to keep stuff by zoning it into certain parts of town. But the reality is, and the reality that these communities in Pennsylvania have met up face to face with and decided to deal with, not to be intimidated by, is that our communities, our municipalities, our cities and towns cannot say no if a corporate directors decide to come into the community with what the state and the federal government regard as a lawful business. And they also cannot say yes to what they want. I mean, there are many communities that are looking, to fulfill a kind of vision of what they want to, what kind of community they want to be. They cannot set those transitions in motion because of the political and lawful power that the corporate directors can wield. Again, we're talking about a handful of corporate directors and essentially nullifying the will of a majority of a community. So that brings us to the title of my talk, which is When Injustice is Legal, What Do the Abolitionists have to teach us about dealing with this kind of situation, with challenging what we would call corporate rule? Can we look back to the people's movement that took place from the 1830s or so to the end of the Civil War? Do we have anything to learn from them? A short summary of what we can learn from them I'm going to talk about initially. But first I wanted to just quote something from a man named A.J. Mustey, who was a labor leader and a pacifist and an extraordinary negotiator, particularly as he got older. And he was a longtime director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. He was very active all his life, but the last part of his life during the Vietnam War. And he wrote, "There is sometimes a tendency to refrain from stating issues sharply and clearly, to gloss over differences, perhaps on the pretext that our agreements are so much greater than our differences after all, and that bringing out the issues and focusing them does not work for reconciliation." And I'm very much in agreement with Mustey that in order to have reconciliation, we really have to focus, we have to sharpen our focus, and we have to not gloss over the disagreements. And that was something that I think the abolitionists were very, very clear about. They did not gloss over differences. And I think as the white abolition movement, which started up in the 1830s, when they started to come together and talk about slavery, they really made an effort over several decades to try to understand what the problem was before they jumped into solutions. At the time in the early 1830s, the dominant sort of anti-slavery organization was the American Colonization Society. Its goal was to send freed slaves to Liberia, to Haiti, to other countries, anywhere but in the United States. They had a significant amount of resources, funds. They dominated the debate before the white abolition movement began. And what began to happen in the 1830s, again, a lot of it taking place here in Ohio at the Lane Seminary in Cincinnati and at Oberlin and other places, they asked the question, what's the problem here? Is it the racism and the cruelty and the excess? What is it we want to solve here? And the answers were not self-evident. Because if the problem, and it's really quite crucial, because if they define the problem as cruel masters, then the solution that they would work for would be to make kinder masters. Maybe eventually set up a slave protection agency like the EPA or a National Slave Labor Relations Board, something like that, to regulate the relations between the slave workers and their masters. And, there would have been a certain logic if they had determined, well, the problem is we have too many cruel masters, and that's what we're going to address. Or if they would say, well, we aspire to something else, but that's the best. We have to be realists. And so that's the best we can get. You know, maybe we set our sights on a slave protection agency. That's the best we can get. And it will do a lot of good for people. Instead, they engaged in very intense debates, discussions, arguments. And they came to a very different perspective. And that perspective was that there's something fundamentally wrong in the law of the land, in the Constitution itself. Slavery was legal. Slavery was written into the Constitution. The Constitution, the law of the land, enabled, basically, a relative handful of people to enslave a huge, you know, an entire class of other people. The law enabled it. It didn't just protect it. The law enabled it. It made it possible. If you look at in the Constitution, if you look at the runaway worker clause, the bonded servant clause, even if a slave ran away to a free state, the public officials and the citizens of that free state were required under the Constitution to seize that slave and return the slave to his master without any due process of law, without a trial, without the slave being charged with a crime, without appearing before a jury. The slave was obviously rightless. The slave was property. You had the three-fifths clause of the Constitution, which enabled, basically said, the more property and slaves were held in southern states, the more representation in the House of Representatives they had, the more representation in the Electoral College they had. So it's perfectly logical that except for the Adams father and son up through Andrew Jackson, all the presidents came from the largest slave state, the most powerful, wealthiest slave state, Virginia. And up through the Civil War, the House of Representatives was totally dominated by the slave states, such that in 1836, it passed a gag rule banning, the House of Representatives banned discussion of slavery on the House floor into the 1840s. It would not accept any petitions dealing with slavery for those years. So that you had the rights of property written into the Constitution spilling over and controlling the political process, empowering this minority to control the whole country. The abolitionists also understood that slavery was not just something confined to the South. They've called it a slave system, the basis of the around which the economy and much of the social relations of the country were built, of the whole country, not just the South. So, I mean, not only did you have northern banks and merchants invested in, you know, holding the mortgages and plantations, invested in the slave trade. Anybody's been to Newport, Rhode Island, and see those big mansions there in Newport today, those mansions all came out of the slave trade. There's also significant slavery in the North. The slave system was so developed and was so powerful nationwide that before the abolitionists started to gather steam in the 1830s and 1840s, or as they were gathering steam, it was still regarded as treasonous in the North to talk against slavery. And many abolitionists were, in fact, subject to mob violence. Samuel Lovejoy was actually killed. Others were killed. William Lloyd Garrison, one of his first speeches in the Boston Commons, was dragged around the Commons with a rope by a rope around his neck. And the city of Boston, the state, did nothing to vindicate the rights of, you know, the so-called First Amendment, the rights of free speech and assembly of abolitionists. Certainly in the South, no white person could hold a meeting at her home or in the public place to talk about abolition, to talk about freeing the slaves. There was no First Amendment. There was no Bill of Rights in the South, in the slaves, North or South. Slavery was seen as central to progress, to jobs, to wealth, to the good life. I mean, that slavery was what was keeping the country together. And so anybody that spoke against slavery was actually talking about disunion and was considered a traitor, North and South. It was in that atmosphere that the abolitionists began to talk about this stuff and to put it in the context of rights denied, to put it into the language of rights and rights denied, to put it into the language of the ideals of the revolution, to put it into the language of the Declaration of Independence. You know, going back to sort of very basic theory that a free government exists to vindicate rights, that people have inalienable rights because we are born as humans. I mean, going back, this is theory and discussion, going back hundreds and hundreds of years to the levelers and diggers, say, in the 1600s, early 1600s in England, which became some of the cornerstone ideas of the Declaration of Independence, that we are born with inalienable rights, which precede the formation of government. So why would people who have inalienable rights form a government whose job was to deny rights or to enable a few people to lord over many people? They went right to that theory, they went right to the Constitution, and basically came to the conclusion that they could not envision achieving the goal of emancipation and equality, of a country without slavery, a country where people were free and self-governing, under the existing Constitution, under the existing set of laws and culture. And so they set out to change that. Now, how did I get to the abolitionists? Well, about 20 years ago, I would say, in about 1985, I had come to the conclusion, and I'm sure many other people did as well, that this country needed a significant transitions in investment and production, manufacturing, and work and consumption. That from an ecological standpoint, from a workers' rights standpoint, from an equity standpoint, the data were pretty overwhelming in every arena. Even though there were millions of people, there had been for a long time, millions and millions of people who had formed thousands and thousands of groups, civic groups, activist groups, issue groups, and had been courageously and valiantly organizing and mobilizing and passing laws and filing lawsuits and marching and writing books and tracts and going to jail and doing, you know, civil disobedience. The work hadn't been adding up. You know, in the context of were communities better able to actually govern themselves, to do what they needed to do? You know, were we any closer to transitions in energy and food and transportation and health in 1985 than we were in 1965? I didn't think so. So much of the organizing seemed to be single-issue defense, one issue at a time. Basically defense, trying to stop some stupid idea, some destructive investment, some destructive kind of production system. And then over and over again, with very little spilling out across issue, across constituency lines. I decided I wasn't going to do single issue defense anymore. And I began to explore. I thought, well, maybe what I'm going to start looking at is, why is it so hard in this country? Why has it been so hard in this country? Even when majority sentiment seems to be going in a certain way to bring about fundamental change. You know, I'll put it to myself. I grew up, you know, being taught that, well, the Constitution and the federal Constitution and state constitutions provide extraordinary mechanisms for constitutional change, for change through politics. You know, we know what you have to do. You just organize and you write the books and you get the data out there and then, you know, you go to your public officials and persuade them and they'll eventually do the right thing. But you look back at American history and say, well, how long did it take to get rid of slavery? Right? And what did that require? You know, generations of struggle and a lot of blood and death and then this horrible, ghastly civil war with 800,000 casualties, you know. And then what about Jim Crow, legal segregation? How long did it take to end that? How long did it take women to get the right to vote? How long did it take for working people to get unions declared not to be criminal conspiracies? I mean, to get the right to organize, you know. We're talking generations and generations in each case. Why has it been so difficult that even when there's large numbers of people, huge numbers of people moving in a certain direction to fundamentally bring about the changes that they're seeking? And why has it been, conversely, why has it been so relatively easy for the slave master class and then the corporate class to change the law, in fact, to amend the Constitution, pretty much at will. A joking kind of question is, how do five men change the Constitution, amend the Constitution? Used to be all men. They've become Supreme Court justices. Because the Supreme Court has very often amended the Constitution. So while citizen movements have to spend generations organizing and struggling and bleeding and dying to change the Constitution, you have federal judges changing the Constitution with a stroke of the pen without a drop of sweat coming off their brow. My interest was not theoretical. My interest was in going back to the work and say, well, I mean, what is it we need to know in order to be more effective as citizen organizers, as human beings? How do we have to change ourselves in order to bring about the changes we want? These, you know, not just to stop something here and there, but to bring about the large-scale changes in energy, agriculture, transportation, in self-governance. Was there something that we could learn from American history that would help make us better organizers?
That was the first half of a one-hour talk by Richard Grossman, the preeminent anti-corporate campaigner. It was given in Yellow Springs, Ohio in November 2006. Richard Grossman died of cancer in November 2011, and I hope this remembrance keeps his inspiration alive. Come back for part two of this talk when Richard Grossman illuminates his extraordinary claim that after the Civil War, the corporate class of the North joined the slave masters in the South to destroy Reconstruction and to end the Second American Revolution. And in fact, the corporate system we're living under today has claimed rights under the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that were intended to protect the liberty of people. In the last 15 years of his life, Richard Grossman had been an important member of POCLAD, the Project on Corporations, Law and Democracy, and CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. His lasting legacy are the democracy schools that continued to be taught by CELDEF across the country. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order a CD of Richard Grossman by calling 1-707-463-2654. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.